row of jilted brides. A few were without their heads. Dimly, from the back of Fever's memory, their names came wafting. Salvage, Rusty, Clockwork Joe. "There's another chamber," she said, "and then another beyond that." They moved toward the dead stalkers. There was a narrow door in the wall behind them. They wove a path to it between the spiky, silent figures, and Wavy kept her strange gun ready. Corvus shoved open the door and pushed through it into a second chamber, identical in size and shape to the first. Fever, Wavy, and the other stalkers went after him. These rooms were hexagonal, fitted together like the cells of a honeycomb. In this one were shelves of strange old medical devices, and a slab just like the one on which Kit Soland had been remade as Grike. Fever remembered being Godsawk, standing at that slab to fumble in the brains of the living and the dead. She remembered the sharp off-white smell of the chemicals, the deep copper tang of blood. She did not remember the little cot that her torch revealed in the shadows behind it. Here in this room, she too had been remade. She let her light go wandering over the rows of vials and syringes, the ranked bottles with their dusty, unreadable labels, the cobwebbed trays of Catlins and retractors. How hard and patiently the old man must have worked down here to save his tiny granddaughter. And for the first time it occurred to her that perhaps he had not simply done it out of a desire to fill her head with his own thoughts and memories. Perhaps Godsawk's consciousness was not inside her after all. Maybe he had failed to transfer more than a few fragments of himself into those old stalker brains he'd brought back from the north. And maybe he had known he'd failed. When he put that machine in Baby Fever's brain, it might not have been an attempt to preserve his own personality. It might have been just a last desperate effort to save his daughter's child. An old man, alone with a dying baby, grabbing up an abandoned experiment and thinking, "Let's see if this does any good." Perhaps he realized, there at the end, that immortality wasn't won by designing engines, or building sky-high statues, or stuffing your thoughts into other heads, but just by keeping your children and their children safe, so that they could carry something of you on into the future. Not your opinions, or your silly memories of pools and parties and kissing people in parks, but the deeper memories, written in your genes, the shape of a nose, the curve of an eyebrow, the little habits and mannerisms which endure through families, through history. Perhaps he hadn't even known, when he placed that device in Baby Fever's brain, that it contained anything of himself at all. And Fever, standing in his workroom now, felt for the first time a sort of affection for him, and a sort of gratitude. She looked up. Grike stood nearby, the green light from his eyes flickering as he studied the slab where Godsawk had tinkered with his stalkers. Was he remembering his own creation, in Wavy's resurrectory? Or was some deeper feeling stirring in him? Fever watched uneasily as his bared claws flinched. Told herself not to be silly. He's not Kit Solent. He's just a machine now. Wavy, meanwhile, had crossed the room along with Corvus and Lammergeier and thrown open another door. "Fever," she said excitedly, "come and look. Wait till Quercus sees this." But as Fever started to move toward the doorway, the stalker Grike barred her way. "What am I?" he asked. She hadn't heard him speak before. He had the same flat, awful voice as the other stalkers, nothing at all like Kit Solent's. The bladed hand he raised in front of her was trembling. "Who am I? What has been done to me?" I don't, said Fever, not knowing what to say. But before she could say anything, Grike's fellow stalkers had reacted. She saw their heads whip round at the sound of his voice, visors down and green light flaring through the eye slits. In the Lazarus Brigade, it sometimes happened that a battle-damaged stalker would go mad, lashing out at his comrades, even claiming to remember his mortal life. They knew what had to be done. They turned toward Grike, and the crash of armour against armour echoed from the low roof. Fever threw herself sideways as Grike stepped back out of the way of Corvus's blades. Whatever had gone wrong inside his stalker's brain, it had not slowed or weakened him. He recovered in an instant, slammed Corvus's second blow aside, and drove his own blades through the other stalker's armour, deep into the organs and machinery beneath. There were sparks and a glittering spray of fluids. Corvus gave a grating roar, and Grike drew back and struck again. Corvus fell sideways, spewing smoke and a smell of burned wiring, the green glow of his eyes going out. Lamagaya circled warily, just beyond the reach of Grike's talons. In the doorway of the inner chamber, Wavy Godsork appeared, the magneto pistol in her hands. "Something's gone wrong with him!" Fever screamed. "Stop him!" Her mother raised the pistol, pointing it at Grike's head. Grike lunged forward, seizing Lamagaya by his armoured wrists. The vault was too small a space for such large creatures to fight in. An upended shelf spilled laboratory glassware. A cabinet was kicked into splinters. Grike twisted Lamagaya sideways, shielding himself with the other stalker's body as Wavy pulled the pistol's trigger. The pistol made a thin whining sound, almost lost in the clash and scuffle of the struggling stalkers. Lamagaya, caught by its blast, went rigid, juddering. Grike levered his head off, shoved the body aside, and strode toward the door, where Wavy stood fumbling with the magneto pistol.
"Wavy!" screamed Fever.
She saw Wavy look up, and watched her realize that she had no time to recharge the pistol. Her face was a ghastly green in the light from the stalker's eyes. He smashed her aside, looked through the doorway into the far room, then turned back. The beams of his eyes swept past Fever, but he was not interested in her. He looked again at Godsork's cobwebby equipment, then turned and went striding from the chamber. Fever heard him go crashing through the first room, blundering out into the antechamber, heard his heavy footfalls go stamping up the stairs and into silence. For a moment she felt too frightened to move, but she shut her eyes tight and repeated the laws of motion until she felt stronger. Then she picked up her lantern and stepped over the wreckage of Lamagaya and Corvus to the inner door. She had prepared herself to see her mother dead, like Kit Solent on the heath. But Wavy was still moving, sprawled on the stone floor of the inner room. Above her, forgotten, Godsork's giant city-shifting engine stood like a huge totem, reflecting gleams of lamplight from 100 dusty fins and ducts. Fever knelt down by her mother, and a sudden Godsork memory showed her Wavy as a little girl, fallen over on the drive and crying, "Ow! Ow! Ow!" "Ow!" said Wavy, shifting, trying to find comfort on the hard, dusty floor. She found none. The stalker's blades had not ripped her, but his armoured fist had struck her like a hammer and flung her hard against the engine. Bones had shattered. Tears of pain shone on her face, and the sight of them filled Fever with panic. What should she do? What should she do? "Go back to London, quickly," her mother said, reaching up and touching her, stroking her face with a shaking hand. "There is something wrong with that stalker. The brain I put into him must have some fault. I should not have brought him here. It is irrational to build machines whose principles you do not understand and whose actions you cannot predict," said Fever, her engineer's attitude spilling out in spite of herself. "This mobile city you propose will be the same. Where will it lead?" Wavy wasn't listening. "Go, Fever," she said. "What if the stalker returns?" Fever looked sideways and saw the magneto pistol lying on the floor. A small green light shone like a sequin on its handle to let her know that it was charged. She picked it up, and it felt odd and heavy in her hand. "Leave me that," begged Wavy. "Go!" "I'm going to go and find Master Solent," said Fever. "It would be unwise to leave him alone up there." "Why can't you do as you're told? He could kill you." Wavy struggled to raise herself, but the pain was too much, and she fell back, half fainting. "Great Scrivener!" Fever stood up, backing away from her. "Someone else will come soon. Quercus will come, won't he, when his fight is won?" It felt wrong to leave her mother there, weeping with pain and unable to move. But feelings mean nothing, Fever reminded herself. She gripped the magneto pistol and went quickly out of the vault and up the stairs that led to the old garden. Chapter 37 The Magneto Gun. Ruin had promised that it was going to be fun, but Ruin was silly because it wasn't fun at all. They had come all through that horrid tunnel, scared of ghosties and dapplejacks all the way, and the walk had made their legs ache very badly, and at the end of it there was just a horrid room with boxes in it, and they couldn't sleep there because it smelled funny and they were scared the ghosties might come for them out of the tunnel. So Ruin had found this door, and they'd sneaked up the steps and reached another door and gone out through it into open air, and there'd been trees and the moon. And Ruin had said, "Now it will be fun. We'll sleep under the stars like children in a story." But it still wasn't fun, because he'd made her climb all up a horrible steep hill, and her shoes had got wet, and she'd dropped Noodle Poodle, and they'd had to find him in the dark, and at the hill's top there was a horrid ruin just full of ghosties, so they didn't go in there, but went round it instead, and found a sort of summer house with moss and ivy instead of a roof, and they went in there and Ruin covered them over with leaves the way the helpful birds did to the children in the storybook, only it didn't work because the wind blew through all the holes in the summer house, and the leaves that were dry blew away and rustled like ghosties in the corner, and the leaves that were wet were cold and clammy. So she'd cried and said she wanted to go home, and Ruin had cried too, and they'd been afraid to put the candle out, and he'd read them a story out of the red storybook, and somehow they had fallen asleep. Now Fern was awake, all cold and stiff. It was horrible sleeping outside. She wanted Daddy, and she wanted to go home. Ruin was still sleeping, with his hair flopped over his face. "Wake up, Ruin," she said, but he just grunted at her and stayed sleeping. She rummaged in the bedspread bundle, and found a bit of cake for breakfast, and went outside with it, breaking off crumbs to give to Noodle Poodle. It was just starting to get light, and it was very quiet because even the birds were still asleep. There was mist all round the hill, and the hill stuck out of the top of it in sunlight, and little jewels of water were shining on the grass. And up the hill, out of the mist, came a man made all out of metal, with knives for fingernails. Fern looked at him. He looked at Fern. Fern smiled at him. "It's Daddy!" she shouted, and ran toward him as fast as her fat little legs would carry her. There were footprints all the way up the stairs. The new stalker's huge blank prints, and Fever's scuffly boot marks from the day before, and here and there a tiny print, like the print of a child's shoe. Fever, running toward daylight and the open air, was so confused by Godsock's crowding memories that she imagined those footprints might be Wavy's, and Wavy still a little girl. The door at the top of the stairs still stood wide open where the stalker Grike had shouldered his way out. Outside, mist hung thick and white above the dripping bushes. Fever started climbing and stopped on the first terrace near one of the pools. The mist pressed close all round her, as if she were something precious wrapped in cotton wool. The pool in front of her was green with weed, but at the same time, superimposed upon it, she could see it as it had looked 20 years before. She went down on her hands and knees on the mossy concrete at the edge of it, and looked down, and she saw, a surface of small green leaves packed so tight that the water was hidden, and B, a clear pool 6 feet deep, with speckled carp drifting lazily beneath the lily pads. She pinched herself, trying to dim the insistent memories. She was not Godsawk, and nor was she the daughter Wavy wanted her to be, or the engineer Dr. Crum had wanted to turn her into. She was sick of being the vessel for other people's hopes. The weight of the strange gun in her hand made her think of Kit Solent and the thing he had become. If she could just find him and use the gun on him, at least she would have achieved something for herself. But how was she to find him in this fog, with Godsawk's memories flitting between the trees like phantoms? She was about to shout his name when she heard another voice, a child's voice, high above her in the mist. "Daddy!" She knew then who it was that had come through the tunnel ahead of her and opened the door. She knew who had made those small footprints on the stairs. She knew that Fern and Ruin had come to Nonsuch Hill, and that the new stalker had found them there. But at the same moment, and before she could react to that new knowledge, she heard someone come out of the doorway below her and start running uphill toward her. "Quick!" she said urgently, turning, imagining that it was Quercus or some of his men, freshly arrived, through the tunnel. But it was Charlie Shallow. All through the dark of that tunnel Charlie had crept, following their voices and the light of their lanterns far ahead. He'd kept urging himself to go faster and catch them up, but he was scared of the machine men, and he knew he couldn't bring himself to shoot the girl when she was close to that older lady. She might not even know that Fever Crumb was a Scriven, and it would be terrible to kill a proper human by mistake. So he hung back. He hung so far back that he heard the crash and clatter of the stalkers fighting while he was still sneaking along the tunnel, and of course he could not know what it was. When he reached the tunnel's end, he saw the big door opposite him standing open. He could see nothing of his quarry, but there were faint voices and lights and shadows moving in some deep inner chamber. It was a strange place, all right, full of old tech and old magic. It scared him. So he waited at the tunnel's end, watching the open doorway of the vault and wondering what to do. And after a while his vigilance was rewarded, because the girl came out, just her alone. He had the spring gun ready, but he hadn't time to steady his nerves and shoot, and she went past him and through that other door without even looking at him. He was still scared, but he knew that this was the best chance he was likely to get, and he had to jump at it for Bagman's sake. He crept past the vault entrance, and then pelted up the stairs. Emerging into the mist, he felt a heartbeat's dismay. How was he to find her? Then he thought of the ruin on the hilltop. That was where she would be. Something about the old house drew her. He looked down, and there were her footprints, dark green on the dewy grass. Following them, he ran up the hill, scanning the mist ahead of him. But he was looking for someone his own height or taller. He didn't see Fever crouched in front of him until she shouted, "Quick!" By then, he was almost on top of her. Fever tried to scramble out of his way, but he swerved to miss her at the same moment, and he went the same way as she. "Sorry," he heard her say, as he crashed into her, tripped over her, and fell. He landed hard on the grass, and the spring gun was jarred out of his hand. He saw it go. It went slowly, like something in a bad dream. It skipped once off the concrete on the side of the pool, and dropped over the edge with a plop like a big frog jumping. He could see little individual leaves of duckweed in the spurt of water it threw up. When he reached the pool's edge himself, there was a gun-shaped hole of dark water in the surface of the weed. He plunged his hand in, shoulder deep and groping, but he could not touch the bottom, and all the time the girl was behind him, and he turned and saw her standing, staring down at him with her ill-matched eyes, her mouth opening to say something or scream for help or something. And she started to run, and then hesitated, looking down for something she'd dropped in the grass, and he looked too and saw it first. It was this other gun, a weird-looking one, all wires and stuff, and he grabbed it quick before she could, and rolled over and pointed it up at her. "Oh, don't be ridiculous," said Fever. "That's not a... that won't harm me." And then she remembered the machine in her head and realized that it might. The boy was shaking, terrified, and the magneto pistol was shaking too, but not enough to make him miss. She watched him pull the trigger. There was an astonishing pain, a hard white flash, then nothing at all. Chapter 38. We Are the Dead. She fell on the grass. She lay on the grass with her feet turned in and her arms thrown out to either side, her right arm stretched across the concrete at the pool's edge, her right hand hanging down into the water. Charlie scrambled up and wiped his nose on his sleeve and looked at the gun, wondering if there was another shot in it. But he didn't need another. Fever lay still. Her eyes were open very wide, as if in amazement at what he'd done, and they didn't blink. You could hardly tell any more that they didn't match, because the pupils had flared huge and owlish, two wells you could look down into the dark unknown. When he reached out and touched her face, her head flopped sideways, and a leak of blood like a thick red worm came out of one nostril and started to creep across her face. That was when, too late, Charlie realized that Bagman had been wrong. Not just Bagman, but all the Skinners. Wrong, wrong, wrong. Maybe Fever Crumb had been a Scriven, and maybe she hadn't. But what would it have mattered if she'd lived? What difference would it have made to the world if she'd grown up and had sons and daughters just like her? None, he thought. Or at any rate, not enough to make it worth doing the thing that he'd just done. She'd been a person like him, and he had killed her. He threw her gun away as he went running down the hill. He lost Bagman's hat somewhere, too. He ran into those trees that broke like green surf around the hill's foot and hid himself there, trying to get the memory of Fever's dead face out of his head, knowing that it would keep coming back to him forever. On Nonsuch Hill, the boy's running footsteps faded into the mist. Inside Fever's body, machines no larger than germs swarmed in her blood and in the clear reaches of her spinal fluid. Many drifted powerless, destroyed by the magnetic pulse that had disabled the old machine nested in the root of her brain. But there were multitudes of them, and the ones that had survived went on with their patient, endless work, repairing damage and harvesting waste energy from her muscles and synapses. Some clustered round the machine, while others busied themselves with her stilled heart. They were brisk and mindless and very good at what they did. 30 seconds after the magneto pistol fired, 20 seconds after Charlie Shallow turned tail and ran, Fever shuddered and flailed her arms and swallowed a gulp of air and started coughing. She wiped her eyes and looked for the boy. She didn't know she'd been unconscious. To her, it seemed as if he'd vanished. She saw the magneto pistol lying in the grass and picked it up and thought at once of the child she'd heard on the hilltop. She staggered to her feet and started climbing. She felt vague and groggy, and she had sprained her knee in falling, which made her limp. She was halfway up the hill before she realized that her nose was bleeding. She had almost reached the top before it occurred to her that this one hillside in the damp present was all she could see, this overgrown garden, this mist. She remembered the old garden, the float lamps and the carp ponds, but the memories had no weight anymore. They were just the memories of memories, already growing colourless and fragmentary, like spent dreams. The flash of the magneto pistol had driven Godsawk from her head. Was she glad, or was it grief she felt? She wasn't sure, and nor was there any time to think about it. For as she climbed, the mist had thinned, and now she stepped out of it altogether, up into the dawn sunlight on the hill's top, and the sharp shadows stretching from the ruined walls. A little way from her, Fern and Ruin were waiting, hand in hand. And a little way from them, with all his blades unsheathed and dazzling in the sun, there stood the stalker. "Stop!" she shouted, and "No!" the words tumbling over one another in her haste to get them spoken. She went as fast as she could on her sprained leg toward the children, and as she went she lifted up the magneto pistol, wondering how close to the stalker and his terrible knives she had to be for it to work. But the stalker, though he looked round at her, did not move. Nor did he move toward the children. He had unsheathed his blades, but he had not used them. Did that mean that there was some trace of Kit Soland still inside him somewhere? Was it possible that some residual memory in his brain recognized Fern and Ruin and could not harm them? He had closed his visor, as if to shield them from the sight of his dead face. The children looked at Fever. "Miss Crumb," said Ruin. She lowered the pistol. She had wanted to destroy Grike, but she didn't now, not if he meant the children no harm. He was too fine a piece of engineering, and she felt a sort of kinship with him. Perhaps one day, inside his mind, Kit's memories would ignite again. But still in the sunshine those blades gleamed, twitching restlessly now and then, and she could not quite trust him. She let the gun hang by her side and held out her empty hand to Ruin. "Ruin, come here." "It's Daddy," said Fern excitedly, pointing at the stalker. Fever shook her head. "This isn't your father. Come away from him." Obediently, the children came to her. Ruin was carrying a big bundle, wrapped up in a very dirty cloth. The little girl held Noodle Poodle tight and kept looking back at the stalker, who turned to watch her go past him. "Why did he look like Daddy if he isn't Daddy?" she asked loudly. "People do look like other people sometimes," said Fever, picking her up and turning away, listening all the time for the sound of the stalker coming after her. But the stalker just stood there watching as Fever, with the girl in her arms and the boy beside her, went down the steep slope of the garden and walked into the mist, like someone walking into a white sea. He was going to live a long time, that stalker. The movement would send him north, where he would become one of the fiercest warriors of the Lazarus Brigade, and in later years he would serve many other masters, until his battered armour was a palimpsest of stenciled insignia. And always there would be this flaw in him, this softness when it came to small children, and he would never understand why. So he stood and watched them walk away from him into the mist, and just before it hid them from him, the little girl raised her hand and waved goodbye. While she was up in the sunshine, Fever had felt very clear about what to do. Once she was down in the mist again, she grew uncertain. Where was she to take the children? What future would there be for them in Quercus's London? "Are we going to find Daddy?" asked Ruin. "Your father is dead," said Fever. The children accepted it quietly. Fever stopped to get a better grip on Fern, and went on through the mist. Ruin walked trustingly beside her. "What will happen to us?" he asked, in a small voice. "I do not know. Do you have any relatives who might look after you?"
"No,"
he said, holding back tears. Fever thought, "I'll take them to Dr. Crumb. Dr. Crumb will know what to do." But he wouldn't, would he? He would tell her to do the rational thing, which would be to give Fern and Ruin to the civic orphanage to care for, or he would make them shave their heads and bury their feelings and try to turn them into little engineers. She stopped walking. They were close to the door that led into the hill, and sounds were coming out of it, tramping footsteps and echoey military shouts in northern accents. The movement were coming through the tunnel to Godsawk's vault, and she felt relieved that there would be help for Wavy, and then unhappy because she didn't want to be any part of Quercus's strange plans for London, and she didn't want Fern and Ruin taken from her, as she was sure they would be.
"Miss Crumb," said Ruin, sensing her confusion and starting to grow afraid.
"It is all right," she promised him. "Come this way." She turned away from the door and pushed downhill through scrub and long grass till she saw reeds ahead of her and water beyond the reeds. Turning right at random, she walked along the edge of the lagoon for a way, and there ahead of her, as if she'd planned to find it, there was a wooden jetty, and drawn up on the bank beside it, the little round boat that had brought Bagman Creech and his boy to Nonsuch House. She thought, "I can't go off in that. What will Wavy think when she sends people out to look for me and I am gone? And Dr. Crumb, what of Dr. Crumb?" And then she got into the boat anyway, shoved it into the water and got into it, and had Ruin hand Fern down to her and then get in himself. "The water's coming in," said Ruin, but Fever said it was all right. They would not sink unless a lot more water came in, and if a lot more water did come in, then Ruin would be allowed to bail. She found the paddle under the seat and started paddling them away from the jetty, which faded quickly into the mist behind. She still half believed that she was going back to London to find Dr. Crumb, but she knew that if she did, he would want everything to go on as before. The Order would have new premises, and the engineers would all be busy working on the new city, bolting the movement's traction fortress onto the Barbican and fitting wheels and the new engines, and she wasn't sure she wanted to be a part of that. She wasn't sure that she was ready to go back to being just an engineer, and she wasn't sure she was ready to be Wavy Godsawk's daughter, either.
Chapter 39. Crumbs of Comfort. While London was distracted by the duel at the Barbican, more and more of the movement's soldiery had been arriving on Ludgate Hill. Now that the duel was ended, they were suddenly everywhere. Up Bishopsgate came more vehicles, not just monos but land barges and traction bunkers, some so wide that they bashed balconies and drainpipes off the houses as they rumbled by. Quercus's doctors attended to him in the open, on the Barbican steps, where his new subjects could see that he was not too badly hurt. Meanwhile, his warriors started rounding up former councillors and other Londoners who would be able to help them restore order and keep the city working. It was not long before they tracked down the Order of Engineers, and not long after that Dr. Staling and Dr. Crumb were hurrying, along with a band of soldiers and stalkers, through the tunnel that led to Nonsuch House.
"Extraordinary," said Dr. Crumb, as their way took them deeper and deeper under the brick marsh. "To think no one knew that this was here."
Dr. Staling was not listening to him. He was too full of Nicola Quercus and his plans. He'd had a brief conversation with the Land Admiral before setting out, and it had left him as giddy as a schoolgirl.
"He has remarkable ideas, Crumb," he kept saying. "Remarkable. There is an engine of some sort in Godsawk's vault, apparently, and Quercus reckons that with a bank of them, he will be able to power a mobile city. Think of it, a whole traction city."
Dr. Crumb thought of it and was not much impressed. "It hardly seems a very rational idea. Trundling about the world, snapping up the things one needs from other cities. And what if those other cities follow suit and start to move themselves? Then only the fittest and fastest would survive. It would be an absurd way to live, a sort of municipal Darwinism."
"But what a spur to progress, eh?" chuckled Staling, who seemed to be finding it hard to control his emotions. "And this Quercus seems a fine fellow. London will support him, I'm sure of that. I believe he should alter his name to something more Londonish, though. Kirk, perhaps."
It was Dr. Crumb's turn not to listen. For Staling had told him before they left Ludgate Hill that Quercus had already sent his technomancer with an advance party along this tunnel, and that it had included Fever. Now he was nearing the tunnel's end. He could hear the voices of the movement's warriors echoing in a new way as they stepped into a larger space. He felt his heart beginning to beat faster and faster at the thought of seeing his daughter again. He was going to embrace her, he decided. He didn't care what Staling said. He was never going to hide his feelings from Fever again. And then, as he stepped out into the antechamber, he heard shouts of alarm from inside the open vault.
"Stay back," warned an officer.
But Dr. Crumb said, "Let me through, I'm an engineer," and pushed past him. He barely noticed the scientific treasures heaped up in the vault's first chamber. He hurried through into the second and saw movement warriors stooping over the wreckage of two stalkers, asking one another in scared voices, "What can have happened here?" He went through the doorway into the third chamber, with men behind him holding up hurricane lamps, Staling saying, "Crumb, look there, the engine!" Dr. Crumb glanced at it, but without much interest.
He had seen the woman lying on the floor beside it, and he went closer to her and saw who she was. He thought she was dead. He wondered if she had been lying down here ever since the riots, her body preserved by some quality of the vault. But when he dropped to his knees beside her, she stirred and groaned and half opened her eyes, and he understood that she was Quercus's technomancer. "Wavy," he said. She frowned and smiled weakly as she recognized him. "Dr. Crumb, always coming to my rescue." He wanted to pick her up and hold her tight, but he could see that she was hurt, so he contented himself with leaning down and kissing her.
"I say, Crumb, steady on," warned Dr. Staling.
"Oh, shut up, Staling," he retorted. And then, "Wavy, where is Fever?" "She went outside. The new stalker ran mad, and she took the magneto pistol and went outside after him." One of the movement soldiers, a medical orderly with a canvas satchel of supplies, was waiting to examine the injured woman. Dr. Crumb waved him forward, gave Wavy's hand an encouraging squeeze, and made his way quickly back through the now crowded vault. "There is a deranged stalker outside," he shouted. He had not even noticed the door that led to the gardens, but he found it easily enough. Three warriors and a pair of stalkers came with him up the stairs. Outside, in the thinning, sun-bright mist, they spread out across the ragged gardens, climbing past the ponds toward the hilltop and the ruins of the house that Dr. Crumb remembered so well. "Fever!" he shouted as he climbed. "Fever!" But there was no answer. He reached the hilltop, and there was no one there except the men who had come out with him, and a tall, new-looking stalker, standing silent with his visor down. "Is he the mad one?" Dr. Crumb asked. The young officer, Captain Andringer, said, "He seems quiet enough now." One of the other men had found a fat, unlikely pistol lying in the grass. He held it up. "Stalker gun here, sir. Shall I decommission him?" Andringer shook his head. "Best not, as he's calmed down. We have few enough left. We'll send him north to the oil country. He can take out his rage on the Arkhangelsk shock troops at Hill 60. More stalkers came clanking up the steep lawns. They had been searching the reed beds around the hill's foot. One of them carried a thing that looked like a bundle of soggy clothes, but which turned out to be a boy, wet and trembling and terrified. "Sir, we found this fugitive. He is unarmed." "Who are you, boy?" asked Andringer. Dr. Crumb looked at the boy. He knew that crossed knife badge on his tunic. Of course. This must be the boy whom Fever had told him about, the Skinner's boy. He grabbed Charlie by his wet shoulders and wrenched him upright. "What have you done? What have you done with my daughter?"
"Your daughter, sir?" asked Charlie, shivering.
"With Fever Crumb."
Charlie swallowed. He'd never imagined Scriven having parents. He saw the magneto pistol in a warrior's hand and nodded at it.
"I killed her, sir. With that fat gun there."
Dr. Crumb felt a terrifying anger rise up in him, and on the far side of the anger, only emptiness. But before he knew what to do with those wild emotions, Captain Andringer said brusquely,
"He's lying. That's not a real gun. It's technomancy. It shuts down stalkers, but wouldn't harm a human being."
"Well, I still killed her," said Charlie bleakly. "I'm sorry I did, but I did. I fired that thing at her and she fell down dead."
Tears were spilling down his thin little face. Dr. Crumb let go of him. He quietly recited the prime numbers up to 79, and then said, "Show me." Charlie looked round, frightened of the men and their guns and their stalkers. He nodded and started leading the way back down the hill. The mist was clearing now, but it still took him a while to find the pool where he'd left Fever.
"Well?"
asked Dr. Crumb. He knelt down, looking critically at the grass around the pool. It was flattened in one place, as if someone had lain there for a little while, not long before. Charlie shook his head.
"I don't understand, sir. This is the place. See that scrape in the moss? That's where I dropped my own gun. She lay there, sir, and she was dead. I killed her."
He started to cry, big, weary, miserable sobs shaking his thin body. Dr. Crumb put an arm around him, then both arms, remembering how he used to comfort Fever when she was little. "It's all right," he said. He was thinking fast, and as he thought, he smiled. He could hear Andringer and the other men spreading out across the gardens again, shouting, "Miss Crumb! Fever!" He didn't expect them to get an answer.
It's all right, he told Charlie again. She wasn't harmed. She just laid here for a time, and then when you'd gone, she got up and went away. Charlie sniffed hopefully, glad to learn that he was not a killer after all.
We'll find her, then.
No, no, said Dr. Crumb. He straightened up, staring into the mist. He had never been good at understanding other people, but he had been observing Fever for 14 years, and he felt he had enough evidence to construct a hypothesis. If she wanted to be found, she would have waited near here for us to find her. She wants to be alone. She needs it, needs a chance to think. And he looked out across the marshes, where treetops and the sunlit golden waters of lagoons were showing through the mist, and he felt enormously happy that he could understand what his daughter was feeling. She can look after herself, he said, and when she is ready, she'll come back. He let go of Charlie and turned away, toward the door that would lead him back to Wavy. Before he stepped through it, he stopped and looked back and saw the boy still standing there. What about you? He asked. Do you have somewhere to go? Charlie shrugged. Best come with me, then, said Dr. Crumb. There is an injured woman to be taken back to Ludgate Hill and all manner of equipment to be moved. Yes, come with me. That would be the rational thing. He went back into the hill, and after a while, Charlie followed him. Chapter 40 The Passing Show. Fever paddled for what felt like a long way and saw nothing but a circle of water about 10 feet across, with the coracle in the middle. The children sat in the damp bottom of the coracle and watched her trustingly. Fern said, "Will Daddy come back?" "No, Fern," she explained gently. "He is dead."
"Has he gone to the Sunless Country?"
"There is no such place," said Fever firmly, because she did not believe in telling lies, not even white ones, not even to little girls. Dead people are dead. They do not live on, and they do not come back, except in our memories.
"I want to go home," said Ruin.
"I'm afraid that is not possible," Fever told him. Fern hugged Noodle Poodle tightly and started to cry. It occurred to Fever that she had no idea how to cope with these two children. But then her father had had no idea how to cope with the baby he found in the basket, and he had managed all right. Soon after that the sun appeared, like a flat white hole poked in the mist. There were trees ahead, reed beds, the ruins of a mill. Beyond it, a high embankment. It was not the landfall that Fever had expected. In the mist she had turned west instead of north, but at least she knew where she was. On top of that embankment was the great south road, up which the landhoys came from Chunnel and Brighton and the south coast ports. She brought the boat ashore there, helped the children out, and together they scrambled up the steep bank. On the top was a wide roadway made of packed, crushed chalk. The mist was thinning steadily. You could see it blowing across the road like smoke, and Fever and the children cast shadows now on the grey-white ground. On either side of the embankment, stretches of water gleamed like battered metal. From the north, there came a sound of engines. Out of the mist, moving slow and steady, a lone land barge appeared. The brightening sunlight struck little brilliant highlights from the spikes and stars of its decorated upperworks, and lit up all the colours of its painted bodywork. It jingled with bells and jangled with good-luck charms, and statues of at least 2 dozen gods gazed out from a niche above the driver's cabin to ward off collisions. Above them, in gilded script, were the words, "Persimmon's Ambulatory Lyceum." Fever remembered faintly the play that she had stopped to watch at Summertown, and how the travelling theatre had seemed to her to sum up all the unreason of the unreasonable world. But it felt like immense good luck that had brought it down the Great South Road at that precise moment. So, telling Fern and Ruin to wait on the verge, she stepped out in front of it and raised both arms. Shrill horns sounded. The driver inside his cabin waved frantically until Fever stepped aside. The barge slowed, but it did not stop.
"Can't stop, dear,"
shouted a woman leaning over a handrail on the upper deck.
"If you knew the trouble we'd had to get our old engine started, you'd never make us stop. But if it's passage to the coast that you're after, climb aboard."
Fever wasn't sure that that was what she was after. She just wanted a little distance between herself and London, a time and space to think. But there was no time to consider possibilities, with the gaudy barge growling past her at a steady 5 or 6 miles per hour. She ran to the verge and picked up Fern, calling for Ruin to follow. A man came out onto the open platform at the barge's stern where the plays were performed and reached out to help them all aboard. He was a big man, tall and portly and broad-shouldered. He had side whiskers and a rosy, sunburned face, and religious trinkets hung in tangles round his neck and were stitched into all the seams of his silk coat. He bowed low and smiled a wide, warm smile and announced, "Ambrose Persimmon, tragedian and manager of this humble company. How may we help you, my dear?" Fever remembered seeing Master Persimmon dressed in cardboard armour and a woollen beard only 2 days before. She looked warily at him, and then passed him at the faces of his company, who stared out at her from various portholes and windows and open hatchways. Wondering if she had made the right choice, she said, "You are bound for the South Ports."
"The South Ports, and then onward," boomed Persimmon, in a voice used to speaking over the cheers and jeers of a rowdy audience as well as the din of barge engines. "First to Channel, then east to Hampstead Dam, and after that Frankland or the Plains, or, who knows, where'er the muses lead us. All the way to the Middle Sea, perhaps. I'll take you where you like, my friends, though I, take it you've coin to pay your passage with."
Fever shook her head. She had forgotten that things had to be paid for in the world outside the Order. She hadn't a penny to her name, and she didn't think the children had either.
"Well, never mind," said Persimmon. "You can work your passage. These children will melt the hearts of any crowd. I can just see them in Babes in the Mall, or the Poor Orphans of Dunster. I think we still have the backdrops for that in the hold. And what of yourself, miss? Have you never tried your hand at acting? You've a winning face, and with the right wig—"
Fever shook her head. She knew that she could no more act than fly. But she thought sideways past the problem and said, "I can help you with your engines."
"What's that? Speak up! Project!"
"I can help with the engines," shouted Fever. "I was trained by the Order of Engineers."
"So that's what happened to your hair," Persimmon laughed. "One hardly liked to ask."
Fever touched her fuzzy scalp and tried out a smile. "I'm planning to grow it," she called. She had been planning nothing of the sort, but saying it made it true. She would not have a lot of hair, she decided, just enough to hide her ears and keep her neck warm at the back. She held Fern tight and followed the actor up a tiny, twisting stairway to the open upper deck. Ruin came after them, dragging his bundle. Two actresses who had been rehearsing up there set down their play scripts and came at once to fuss over the children.
"May I present my dear wife and greatest helper," said Master Persimmon reverently, indicating the older of the two, the same handsome lady who had called down to Fever before she came aboard. "Mistress Persimmon's Diana is still spoken of in tones of awe and gratitude by all those who appreciate great acting."
"Master Persimmon is too kind," replied his wife, blushing as she heaved bales and baskets about, and wrestled out some folding chairs for the newcomers to sit on. The younger woman, helping her, shot Fever a frank and friendly smile, as if to say, "You'll be all right with us."
"There has been trouble in London,"
Master Persimmon confided, in a whisper that was still loud enough to cut clearly through the engine racket. He took Fever's arm and guided her gently forward to a clear space near the bows.
"A new man in charge. Big plans, they say. A new era dawns. It could be good for business, but I'd rather be well away till things are settled down."
"Me too," said Fever. She would go to Channel, she thought. She could write to Dr. Crumb from there, and after that... Well, after that, who could say? She had only just found out who she was. She had no idea what she wanted to do with the rest of her life.
"And what are we to call you, dear?" Mistress Persimmon asked.
Fever set Fern down beside her brother. The wind tousled the children's hair, and the silver lagoons slid by on either side of the road, and she stood holding the handrail and looking out into the misty, sunlit land ahead. And as loudly as she could, she said the one thing about herself that she was certain of. "My name is Fever Crumb." This is Philip Reeve. I hope that you've enjoyed this production of Fever Crumb. This program was directed by Sarah Carouche and produced by Paul R. Gagne, with music by Nick DiBerardino. Text copyright 2009 by Philip Reeve. Music copyright 2010 by Nick DiBerardino. Production copyright 2011, Scholastic Inc. All rights reserved. Fever Crumb, unpublished excerpt. There had been some consternation inside the vast metal head when Dr. Crumb first brought Fever home in her basket. The Order had only been living there for a few weeks when it happened. Most of the rooms were still only separated by canvas partitions, and the sound of the child's crying could be heard in all of them. One by one, the members of the Order had looked up from their work, and frowned, and listened, and then gone stumping up the ladders and the rickety wooden stairways, homing in on the source of the noise. Soon there was quite a crowd of them gathered in Dr. Crumb's workspace, jostling for a view of the tiny stranger who lay kicking and squealing in an open drawer of his plan chest. At last even Dr. Staling, the chief engineer, left his big office behind Godsork's right eye and came to investigate. The Order shuffled aside to let him into Crumb's quarters and give him a clear view of the newcomer. Their heads turned slowly from Fever's face to his as they waited to see how he would react to the little intruder. Some of them, the ones who had been at the old engineerium on the night when the explosive research laboratory finally lived up to its name, had seen Dr. Staling look shocked before, but for most it was a new and fascinating sight. His wiry eyebrows rose, his mouth opened and shut, his face turned pale, and the smooth dome of his shaven head blushed pink. He raised a hand to point to the open drawer.
"Dr. Crumb," he said weakly, "what is that?"
"It is a baby, Chief Engineer."
"I can see that, Dr. Crumb. I can see that all too clearly."
Dr. Crumb shuffled awkwardly. He felt most uncomfortable with all those inquisitive eyes turned upon him. He said, "I found her abandoned in the brick marsh, Chief Engineer. It seemed irrational to just leave her there to perish."
"But why bring it here?"
"I did not know where else to take her," said Dr. Crumb. Dr. Staling came across the silent room and peered thoughtfully into the baby's face. It was a great many years since he had looked at a baby. He had forgotten how very small they were. Behind him, some of his bolder engineers clustered closer, peeking over his shoulders to get a look at the little refugee.
"Her name is Fever," ventured Dr. Crumb. "It was written on a label."
"What a ridiculous name," cried Dr. Rincey Tootle.
"All London women often name their children after what ailments afflict them during pregnancy," said Dr. Staling loftily. "I have known of people named bellyache, nausea, even incontinence."
"I can vouch for that," agreed Dr. Craving for Pickled Onions McNee, rather ruefully.
"Wah!"
complained Fever loudly, as if a debate bored her.
"How old do you think it is?" asked Dr. Griffin Wire. "I imagine it is newborn," said Dr. Isbister. "I expect some unreasonable woman abandoned it." "Oh, she is not newborn," blurted an elderly engineer named Crispin Collyhole. He reddened slightly as the rest all turned to stare at him, but went on. "She is far too big, and the eyes of newborn babies are always a cloudy shade of blue. They do not turn colour until the infant is a few weeks old. I should think that this baby is at least 3 months old. I remember when my younger brothers and sisters were born, you see," he added hastily, in case his fellow engineers wondered where his arcane knowledge sprang from. "Perhaps she is hungry," he suggested. "You notice the fretful way that she keeps grizzling. I think she is telling us that she is hungry."
The engineer's attention focused on the child again, considering this new hypothesis.
"We should give it some food," suggested Dr. Isbister. "But what do babies eat?" asked Dr. Wire.
"Milk," said Dr. Staling. "At least, I gather their mothers produce milk for them."
The engineers blanched and looked worriedly at one another in the half-light. How on earth were they to come by human milk? Women were not permitted in the head, since they were distracting and incapable of scientific thought.
"That settles it, then," said Dr. Wire, sounding deeply relieved. "The child must be taken away, into the city somewhere. The new council must have procedures for such things. I'm sure a woman can be found who will, cope with it."
"If you please, sir," said Dr. Crumb, "the child would be in danger in the city. The commons are superstitious, irrational and violent people. It is only a short time since the riots. Bagman Creech and his Skinner's guilds are still on the prowl. A child like this one, with her unusual eyes, might be thought to be a mutation. She has already been injured, look." And he lifted the baby's head to show them a recent scar, healed but still red and angry-looking, at the base of her skull.
"Well, it is not our fault that the commons are brutish and murderous," said Dr. Wire.
"'And it is not as though there are too few babies in London,' agreed Dr. Staling. "'Whether this one lives or dies is a matter of no importance.'
But none of the men in the room made any attempt to take the child away from Dr. Crumb, or to carry her out into the streets. They all remembered too well the horrible things they had seen during the riots. So they stood and watched Fever, wincing slightly as her cries grew louder and harsher. "'Sir,' said Dr. Crumb after a while, glancing hopefully at the chief engineer, "'I think that with a child of this age a little cow's milk might not go amiss, and perhaps some mashed vegetables.' The others looked at Dr. Staling. He nodded slowly.
"'Very well, Crumb. You may attempt to feed the child. It can remain here until the present unrest is settled. But please stop it making that noise.'
Dr. Crumb fed the baby watered-down milk with a laboratory pipette, and she grew quiet at once. The other engineers nodded approvingly and began to drift away, back to their own quarters and their own experiments. Dr. Collyhole stayed behind, showing Dr. Crumb how to hold Fever on his shoulder and pat her back until a startlingly loud belch erupted from her, along with a gloop of half-digested milk which made a long yellowish stain down the back of his coat. Then Dr. Crumb fashioned a clean nappy out of some blotting paper and two bulldog clips and laid her back in her drawer with a clean blanket over her. He stood and watched her, exhausted. At least she had stopped crying. She gurgled and kicked her blanket off.
"'Why does she not go to sleep?' asked Dr. Crumb. "'You told me they go to sleep once they've been fed.'
"'Perhaps you should sing to her,' suggested Collyhole.
"'Sing?' cried Dr. Crumb. "'I do not know any songs. Can't you sing to her? She's your baby.'
"'She is not my baby,' said Dr. Crumb sharply.
He was remembering how his own mother used to sing to him when he was just a little boy, lying in his cot in the damp old bedroom of the farm at Lesser Wintermire. It had had a calming, reassuring effect, as he recalled. Perhaps it would be the thing to lull a child to sleep. But he was certainly not going to start singing. What would the others think of him? He pulled up a chair and sat leaning forward so that his face was directly above the face of the baby in the drawer. She laughed and gazed up at him as if he were the moon. In the softest voice he could manage, he began to recite the periodic table of chemical elements. Hydrogen, lithium, sodium, potassium, rubidium. By the time he reached zirconium, the baby's strange eyes were half closed. A few more elements and she was asleep. Dr. Collyhole tiptoed out, smiling to himself as he returned to his own laboratory at the top of the head. But Dr. Crumb kept up his recitation, taking pleasure both in the calm certainty of the names and the child's soft breathing. In the following weeks, every engineer in Godshawk's Head found an excuse to invade Dr. Crumb's privacy, poking their heads round his door to ask how he was doing, or whether there was anything they might help with, when really all they wanted was another look at the baby asleep in his bottom drawer. No one would ever admit it, but they had all been shaken and upset at being driven out of the old engineerium and forced to take up residence in this draughty head. Baby fever was helping to unite them and making them begin to feel at home. Dr. Jones arrived with a tub of talcum powder.
"'To sprinkle on the infant's bum, Crumb, when you change her whatchamacallits.'
Dr. Isbister, the Order's librarian, googled through all his medical books for hints on childcare. Even peppery old Griffin Wire turned up one morning bearing a mobile he had made by stringing together a lot of cardboard cut-out shapes, squares, triangles, hexagons.
"'If you insist on keeping her here,' he grumbled, "'you might as well give her some grounding in the basic principles of geometry.'
He hung the thing up over the open drawer.
"'There, she'll see it when she wakes.'
Dr. Crumb was afraid she would wake at any moment, for Wire made no attempt to whisper, but Fever slept calmly through it, and did not even stir when he slammed the door firmly behind him on the way out. Dr. Crumb sat and watched the mobile spin slowly in the glow from his dusty windows.
"'Give her an insight into some basic principles,' he thought. "'Well, why not? Most of the Guild's apprentices arrived at the age of 14, their heads stuffed with superstitious nonsense by their parents.' It often took years to rid them of their attachment to their family and their belief in non-existent gods like Poskett and Mama Cellulite and the Thin White Duke. Might it not be better for the Order to take children in as infants, so that they could be taught from the very start that there were no gods, no ghosts, no need for emotions? Why, if this child was brought up by engineers, what an engineer she might become! As if she knew what he was planning for her, Fever woke and started crying with a series of coughing sounds like a small engine turning over on a frosty morning. Dr. Crumb lifted her from her drawer, and after a moment of not knowing what to do, he cuddled her close and said,
There, there, small human being. All is well.
The inspiration for Fever herself really comes from the world of mortal engines. It's a world full of mad science that really couldn't possibly work. And that the fact that it couldn't possibly work didn't bother me at all when I was writing the first four books. But then I started to think, oh, actually, it kind of is a bit silly that all these things kind of break the laws of thermodynamics or whatever. So I kind of felt like introducing a character who is terribly logical and terribly rational and scientific and understands how things work and is kind of irritated herself by the fact that the world around her doesn't really seem to obey these laws. But hopefully she'll probe around and she'll actually start to discover how these apparently mad things do work. And I think having a character who's trying to be very rational and logical in a world that refuses to be either is, it makes for quite an appealing person. So I quite like her bumbling along in her white coat and her logical little way. I think in a long ago book that I wrote that I abandoned, I had a family of characters all named after illnesses. So there was two brothers called Megrim and Ague and a sister called Fever. And I didn't really like them very much, and they got cut out fairly promptly. But I always kept Fever in my mind as quite a good name. And somehow, at some stage, it got mixed up with the name Crumb, and it just seemed to spark off somehow. When you collide two words, you sometimes get quite a pleasant result. And I thought Fever Crumb sounded like the name of a character. And also it sounded like the name of a book in a kind of Victorian Life and Adventures of Fever Crumb kind of way. So that's really what inspired the book. Fever Crumb is related to my Mortal Engines series of books. It's set in the same world, but it takes place centuries and centuries earlier. So it's showing you the beginnings of the world that's described in those other books. When I finished writing the four books that are the Mortal Engines Quartet, I didn't imagine going back and revisiting it. I seemed to have come to an ending, and I thought I'd done everything I could in that world. But as I went off and wrote other books afterwards, I kept on having little Mortal Engines-y ideas. And so eventually I realised I could go back and do something set in the same world but at a different time. So it's almost a different world, but it just has this link through which connects it still to the other books. There are going to be more stories about Fever. I've already written one, A Web of Air, which follows her adventures with the travelling theatre. And I'm at present working on another one called Scrivener's Moon, which takes her back to London a few years later, and we see how Quercus is getting on with his plans to set the city moving. And that follows the stories of Charlie Shallow as well, and Dr. Crumb and Wavy Godsawk, and we find out what's going to happen to all of them. And then after that, there will be at least one more book about her. I don't have any routine when I'm writing. I usually try and start at about 9 o'clock when my son Sam goes off to school, and I usually try and keep working until about sort of 4 or 5 in the afternoon, but I can, you know, quite often no ideas come, so I just go out for a walk and a think instead. Or equally, sometimes I'm busy and I have to keep working much later. And I can write anywhere. I have a room in my house that I generally use, but I can write in the garden or in a cafe or on a train. Or sometimes I take a notebook up on the moor and write up there in the open air. But I've never had writer's block in the sense of not being able to write anything. But I quite often find that I've been writing for 6 months or a year and that none of it's any good, and then it all goes in the bin and I have to start something else. So it's sometimes quite tricky. But touch wood, I've always been able to kind of pull a story together somehow at the end of it. The unpublished excerpt, which I've included on this audiobook, is from a point quite early in the book. And it's where Dr. Crumb first brings baby Fever back to Godsawk's head to live among the engineers, and it's about how all the other engineers react to her. And it was a scene that I quite liked, and it stayed in the book until quite late on. And then really just when I was getting it ready to publish, reading through it, I started to think that it was a bit too slow at the beginning, and it's a book with a lot of flashbacks in it, and this was one more flashback that I felt, nice as it was, it didn't really tell you anything that couldn't be told in a paragraph. So reluctantly I let it go, but it's been restored on here just for
well, for your amusement, I hope.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.